south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander, my thoughts ever stray.
Hi, everybody. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you what it's really like to live, work, play, and or retire in Latin America. I tell it just like it is, so let's get started. I'm recording this show today a few days after that massive earthquake in Guatemala that killed at least 100 people and left at least 5,000 people homeless. And I understand about 20,000 are displaced. Now, I was about 100 miles from the epicenter when everything started shake, rattling, and rolling. And if you're 100 miles away from a 7.2, like I was, it's like being hit with a 6 or a 6.5 from that distance. In fact, in the local papers the next day, the seismologists had drawn a diagram of concentric circles radiating out from the epicenter showing just that. And I've been through earthquakes before, at least 30 that I remember. Mostly just 3s and 4s that gently sway the room a little bit. And nothing at all to worry about, especially if you were in a building like I was in when it hit. But I have to say, this was probably the second biggest one I've ever experienced. I was sitting at my computer on the second floor of a modern, gringo-designed and constructed building when suddenly it got absolutely quiet outside. And about 10 seconds later, it hit. It seems like animals, birds especially, pick up on that stuff way before we do. Anyway, the gringo that owned this place made sure it was truly an earthquake-resistant structure. I'm talking about thick block and concrete walls with plenty of rebar reinforcement. And yes, it did sway quite a bit, and there was some window rattling, but nothing fell off the shelves or hit the floor. And you know, since that earthquake, which was a 7.2 on Eddie's ex-mother-in-law scale, and yes, her name was really Richter, no lie. Anyway, since the big earthquake, I've been getting tons of emails from people wondering if I've been swallowed up by a fissure or something. Well, no such luck. And really, besides the shaking, rattling, and rolling, and some spotty internet service, and a broken water pipe outside, and even that was only brought to my attention about a day and a half later, when the gardener said, "Johnny, look, there's a big wet spot on the grass." Actually, he said, "Don Johnny, there's a big wet spot on the grass." Since, like I said in a past show, everyone who works for you slips the word Don, D-O-N, in front of your name when they address you. Just like they call Marlon Brando in The Godfather, Don Corleone. A term of respect. So, all you wannabes up there, that's another thing you're going to have to get used to when you come down. Think of the famous name Don Juan or Don Quixote. Those are just two Spanish guys named Juan and Quixote. And because they were noblemen or landowners, the working class is obliged to stick that Don term in front of their names. Which is exactly how the common folk address us gringos and expats down here. So, get used to it. Anyway, there was a broken water pipe. And the total cost for that repair? $4 for a new brass shutoff valve. And my gardener slash maintenance man? Well, it took him about 2 hours to dig around it, clear it out, and fix it. And his labor didn't cost anything. He was there on the job anyway as the gardener. And he gets $12 a day no matter what he does. Gardening, electricity, plumbing, plastering, roofing, it doesn't matter. He gets $12 a day. And by the way, down here, they use plastic PVC plumbing tube for everything. Naturally, because it's modern, it's easy, and much cheaper than the older method with copper and galvanized pipe. But the main value of it is that it's flexible, so during an earthquake, you rarely ever have any serious damage. Maybe just a leak or a crack here and there, like I had. But if it's a really big quake and you're near ground zero, all bets are off. So, what else happened around me when that seven-pointer hit? Nothing, just 30 seconds of white-knuckling it, and about 25 much smaller aftershocks that followed it up for the next few hours. Which is kind of strange, because every other time I was in an earthquake that was a 5 or near a 6, there'd only be 2 or 3 perceptive aftershocks in the next couple hours. But in this case, it was like they just kept on coming, though nothing near the intensity of the first big shock. Anyway, just to give you guys the lowdown on what's happening down here in Earthquake Alley, specifically in regards to the dead people, the destroyed homes, and the displaced persons you're seeing all over the internet and in the first world media, well, you have to look at the whole thing like the story of the three pigs, remember? That's expat Eddie's analogy, and I think it's a pretty good one. Remember what the big bad wolf said to the three pigs? I'll huff and I'll puff and I'll blow your house down. Well, like expat Eddie says, us gringos and expats are like the pig that built his house out of bricks and concrete and mortar. And the poor folks down here that are just scraping by, they're like the other pig with the tin shack and the wood and the dirt floor. They just can't afford good, solid, long-term construction. Not to mention they nearly always build their houses on the most precarious pieces of land. Meaning the cheapest land, like land on mountainsides, cliffs, ravines, ledges, and in floodplains. That's why when earthquakes and hurricanes come, these things collectively disintegrate and fall down the sides of hills and mountains. Those are the photo ops you see on the 6 o'clock news up in the first world. You see those poor folks and the wailing and the gnashing of teeth. If you look close on the 6 o'clock news, the only gringos you see in those disaster zones are with the UN or church groups or charity organizations. They don't live there. They came down to help out. Not to mention, in the cities anyway, that's where all the destruction is because these guys build right on top of each other, violating all the zoning rules. That is, if they have any zoning at all, which in crappier sections of town are never enforced anyway. But since these guys are all packed into the undesirable areas of town, and this is the third world, the government always looks the other way and leaves the poor folks alone. That's why from the air and from a distance, they look an awful lot like white trash housing situated right in the middle of a garbage dump, which is not so far from the truth, really. And if you don't believe me, just go on the internet and look up favelas of Brazil. And when natural disaster strikes, those are the people you see in the international news crying in front of a house that's been demolished. You just don't see that kind of stuff in the wealthier areas of town, where they actually have zoning and construction regulations that are actually enforced. Now, just one more thing about anti-seismic construction. I'm talking about the adequate use of concrete block, mortar, brick, and rebar, as opposed to wood, masonite, and drywall, capped off with a tin roof or laminated panels, the kind of crappy makeshift construction you see in the poor sections of town, in what they call the asentamientos or the favelas, the slums. Now, you might notice on the news after a disaster like this, the real destruction, where it looks like it's been bombed out, almost always occurs in the poor residential sections of big cities. But sometimes you'll see what looks like a big commercial center with half the building ripped off, like Godzilla was in town. Now, if you know anything about the way people construct their commercial buildings down here, it turns out in the older, middle-class, and lower-middle-class business sections of town, what usually happens is one little commercial building will pop up, then another, all independently, and eventually after some years, they're wall-to-wall and back-to-back, and soon they look like one big, ugly commercial building or commercial center. But actually, there might be six or seven little buildings that are just smushed together and not connected to each other by any means. Kind of like a haphazard set of kids' building blocks. You push one the right way, the whole thing falls over. So even though it looks like one complete big commercial center building, when a decent-sized earthquake hits, the weakest parts crack and fall away. But in the newer sections of town, where you've got commercial centers that are built as solid, unified structures, it would take a 6 or a 7 at ground zero to do any substantial damage. Now, I talked to a good friend of mine who was on the 16th floor of a 20-story medical complex when a 7.2 Guatemala earthquake hit. And he told me everybody panicked, but there was no place to run. Now, this structure is very modern and only about 3 or 4 years old, with a lot of glass. And he said when he looked out the window, he actually saw the ground heave up and down ever so slightly like a wave coming in on a beach. Now, to me, that would be scary. And as far as I'm concerned, that's one of the reasons I don't want to live in a high-rise tower. Not that I don't trust how they're constructed. That's not the issue at all. Because nearly all these high-rise residential towers and commercial buildings are built by foreign first-world construction companies that specialize in that kind of thing. They absolutely know what they're doing and build for local seismic conditions. These are transnational companies that are first-world, after all. Luckily for us, Latin construction companies aren't big enough. They don't have multi-million dollar cranes and earth movers and specialized excavation equipment to do that kind of work. So when a commercial or residential building is over 4 or 5 stories tall, they got to call in the foreign experts, which for us expats is a very good thing. So if you move your business, your office, or you decide to live in one of these big high-rises, Have a look at the blueprints or ask the manager or maintenance guys to confirm that a foreign first world contractor built that building, or at least had partnered up with a local architect. That way you can be sure that it's been built to local seismic standards. But still, in my case, I prefer not to live or have a business in one of those high-rise towers, even if it's first-class, first-world standards all the way. Why? Well, I tell you, I'm not afraid of too much, but I know the earthquake frequency statistics, so I prefer to live closer to the ground. Though I admit I've never heard of a single high-rise in Latin America that's ever toppled or even crumbled in a quake. But still, it's not for me. Let me explain. It turns out all throughout Latin America, no matter where you happen to be, in whatever city, town, or locale you select, if you do a little internet searching, you'll find that every 25 to 50 years, a 7-pointer or so on the Richter scale will hit, and anything that's 7 or over, or even a 6.5 and over, are pretty scary. And none of the Latin American countries are immune from that. None. For example, you might recall in September, Costa Rica got hit with a 7.9. Now that's huge. If one of that magnitude would hit Los Angeles or San Francisco, that would be the big one that everyone's been predicting for the last 50 years, you know? So of all the great reasons to become an expat and move down to Latin America, you'll still have those damn earthquakes to contend with. And though they're not exactly predictable, they're more or less cyclic and do have a certain periodicity you can count on. So wherever you move in Latin America, you can pretty much expect a few small ones each year, in the range of generally a 3 or a 4. And they do freak out green expats at first, especially guys like me from the Midwest, from Chicago, Minnesota, or Cleveland, who've never experienced such things. But soon enough, that slight swaying feeling becomes old hat. So much so that after a while you don't even mention them to your friends or family. Seems like only green expats will say things like, "Hey, did you feel that earthquake last night?" And for those of us who've been down here a while, we just shrug it off. And when you get one of those 3s or 4s, you can feel your house sway just a tiny little bit. And sometimes you'll get a little door or window rattling, but never any damage. A 3 or a 4 is not even enough to cause a plate to drop or a picture to shift on the wall. But still, you can feel it. But then there's those big ones, the terremotos they're called, when they're over 6 on the Richter scale. Now, they have a certain frequency too. For example, in Peru in 1970, they had a 7.9. In 1972, in Managua, Nicaragua, there was a 6.5. In 1976, Guatemala had their last big one, which was a 7.5. And the one a few days ago, a 7.2, puts those two big ones 36 years apart, which is right in that 25 to 50 year range I just spoke about for really big earthquakes or terremotos. Then in 1979, Colombia had an 8.0. Then in 1985, Chile had a 7.4. Then again in March of 2010, Chile had an 8.8. You remember that? That was one of the biggest earthquakes ever recorded. And those big ones in Chile were exactly 25 years apart. Again, falling within that range of 25 to 50 years I mentioned. Then in 1985, Mexico City has an 8.1. Another one for the Guinness Book. Then in 1986, El Salvador has a 7.5. Then in 87, Ecuador gets hit with a 7.0. In 92, Nicaragua gets a 7, just 20 years after the last big one, which was a 6.5. Then in 2001, Salvador gets a double whammy, a 7.6 followed by a 6.6, just 15 years after the last big one, a 7.5 in 1986. Then in 2007, Peru gets another 7.9, huge, which is 37 years since the last monster they had, which was a 7.9. And I can go on and on, believe me. So what's all this tell you? It tells you that when you come down to Latin America as an expat, you just have to expect earthquakes, and one big one every 20 to 50 years. And here's the thing about those really big ones. As usual, people have very short memories about disasters like that. Let's take that Guatemala example. The last huge one was in 1976. Basically, that means the only people that really remember that thing are people who are 45 years old or more. And since only about 20% of the people in all of Guatemala are over 45 years old, 4 out of 5 people down there have no living memory of it. It's like in the U.S. four out of five people there have no living memory of the Vietnam War either. They weren't born yet or were too young at the time to remember. Now, because very few people in Latin America remember the last big earthquake in their area, their poor keep building those rickety shacks with tin roofs on precarious slopes. And they keep going to church every Sunday and praying to God that it'll never happen again. But it always does. Meanwhile, the people with money keep building their structures out of concrete block, rebar, and brick. So in the end, it's always the poor folks that suffer. Those are the people you see dazed and confused walking the streets like zombies on the 6 o'clock news. And the rest of us, we suffer a bit too, but it's more just an inconvenience for us. The roads crack, the plumbing and the power go out for a while, but again, because people live a lot closer to the earth down here, even the poorest people do cope. And there's generally never a serious food and water shortage. Not for long, not for more than a couple of days. Now think how bad the aftermath of Katrina was, and New York today. And one more thing I'd like to mention. A lot of the old historic colonial Spanish towns down here in Latin America have been hit repeatedly with big earthquakes over the past few centuries. That's why when you tour these places, you see so many ruined monasteries, churches, cathedrals, and palaces. Because you see, back then when the Spanish built these great edifices, they didn't have steel substructures and rebar. No matter how tall and gigantic these structures were, they were just basically stone and mortar. And after a while, those things just couldn't take it anymore, and they crumbled and toppled. The same is true for so many of the common folk down here, especially many poor people in small, out-of-the-way towns in the boonies. They don't build low-class wood and tin shacks, but they build their houses out of traditional adobe bricks, which can look very elegant and classy. But they never hold up during a big earthquake. Adobe bricks are made out of a kind of mud that's not fired in a kiln, like a standard brick is. They're sun-dried, so they're not near as strong. But it's really cheap construction because dirt and mud are everywhere. So a lot of times, when you're in a beautiful, little, rustic Spanish colonial house, underneath all that nice plaster are adobe blocks. Adobe structures in Arizona and the rest of the southwestern United States might be just fine. That's not considered earthquake territory. But down here in Latin America, forget about it. Enough about that. Let's motivate on to a different subject. Now, in the last few shows, I've talked a little bit about GMOs, genetically modified foods. Now, I have gotten a few emails from people asking me just what is genetically modified in this world, and how fast is that crap spreading to Latin America? Basically, what should they keep an eye out for so they can avoid it if they can? Well, if you live up in the first world, I've got bad news for you. Everything and anything that's a corn product is GMO except popcorn. Somehow they haven't gotten around to that yet. And everything that's got that poison called high fructose corn syrup in it is GMO modified too, which is pretty much contained in all your prepackaged food, junk food, and sodas. But the good news is, down here in Latin America, anything that has sugar in it has real cane sugar in it, if it's made down here. If it's imported from the first world, it's going to have that high fructose corn syrup. And as you know, refined cane sugar is still bad for you, but it doesn't suck near as much as high fructose corn syrup. So anyway, these days, the majority of white and yellow corn products are GMOs. So what are the other GMO products? Well, you got soy, cotton and cottonseed oil, nearly all canola oil, alfalfa, zucchini squash, and Hawaiian papayas. Now, down here in Latin America, you have about 5 or 6 kinds of papayas. And the only place you're going to get a GMO Hawaiian papaya is in a first world grocery store. So you don't have to worry about that down here. And about that GMO canola oil, I bet a lot of you are thinking, I don't buy that stuff. I buy olive oil, extra virgin. Well, guess what? It's been reported in some of the big European newspapers that a high percentage of olive oil, even extra virgin olive oil, is being cut illegally with canola oil, which mixes quite well with olive oil and doesn't separate, so you can't tell it's been adulterated without an expensive chemical analysis. So you purists out there who think your olive oil is virgin, you just might be getting polluted with GMOs on the side and you don't even know it. My advice? Switch to 100% cold-pressed coconut oil. There's a lot of good reasons for that, but for one thing, it does not degrade at high temperatures like olive oil. Okay, let's move on to something else. One thing that's always bothered me about living down here in Latin America is that you never, ever know if there's a product recall, like, for example, an auto recall. I've yet to meet anyone who's bought a new vehicle, including myself, who's ever been notified by the dealership that there is a product recall going on. And you'd think that dealers worldwide would be passing that information along to everyone. But they don't. And I know that in the U.S., oftentimes you'll read in your local newspaper that there's a Honda or a Plymouth recall. Did I say Plymouth? Man, am I showing my age or what? Anyway, so often you find out about your recall by reading it in a local newspaper, or by letter or email from the dealer. But down here in Latin America, I've been reading local newspapers for some 20 years now, and I've never seen a recall notice. Though you'll sometimes read it as a news item when a really dangerous problem exists in a certain car model. A problem that's got legs with the media up in the first world. Like when there's been a few high-profile deaths or injuries associated with the defect. Now, I don't know if you knew this, but this year alone, in 2012, which isn't even over yet, already Audi, Buick, Chevrolet, Chrysler, Dodge, Honda, Isuzu, Jeep, Nissan, Porsche, Volkswagen, and Volvo have had factory recalls. And all the owners of those products have been notified by email or snail mail in the first world. And they're supposed to bring their vehicle down to the dealer and get the problem fixed. So that's a third world problem you have to deal with. You just don't get notified. And the best thing you can do, as far as I see, is not to go down to the dealership and ask them, because more than likely you'll get a blank, deer-in-the-headlights kind of look from them. Instead, maybe once a year you should go to this website called autorecalls.org and check your car model and see if it's been pulled for a recall. Otherwise, you're just never going to know. And the same is true about general product recalls. You're never notified about that, and you never read about it in the paper, unless it's a real shocking news item like kids getting strangled in a certain kind of car seat or a stroller. I mean, come on. Every year there's thousands of product recalls, and you hear about them all the time up in the first world. And you know, I'm not really paranoid about this myself, but it is buyer beware. So just know that the same products up in the States have flooded down here to Latin America too. And all those dozens, even hundreds of defective products you read about, the ones that have been pulled from the shelves up in the States, well, they don't pull them from the shelves down here. Oh, and since we're discussing cars, I'd like to point out something I think will shock you. Did you know that after the year 2015, just 2 short years away, all new cars in the U.S. will be equipped with a black box, like a small version of an airplane black box? And that black box is there to record your mileage, your GPS data, all of your destinations, your driving habits, and all the routes you've ever taken. In fact, what it's there for is to track everything you've ever done in any place you've ever gone in that car. Well, you might think, okay, well, I've got a GPS trip tracking device, and it's pretty cool. I've got my Google Earth and Google Maps going, and I just punch in a location, and there it is in real time. Simply a godsend for men, since we hate to ask for directions. Well, think about this for a second. If after 2015 your car will track every route you've ever driven and place you've ever stopped at, what's that information for and who's going to get it? Probably insurance companies and government alphabet soup agencies, of course. What if the NSA or Homeland Security finds out from your black box that you make regular trips to a gun store or a rifle or shooting range? Or maybe you've gone to some third-party political rallies or prepper meetings? So why am I mentioning this? Because in Latin America, there will be no such black boxes. Car companies are not going to spend money to install things like that in countries where they're not required. And how do I know that? Well, I know a couple of guys that work at new car dealerships down here. And they told me the story that back in the 80s and 90s, when pollution regulations got really tough up in the first world, especially California, when car companies had to employ all kinds of tricks under the hood to meet those new pollution standards, as well as installing those expensive catalytic converters. Well, my friends from the new car dealerships down here told me the dealership received identical models without those expensive add-ons. And whether you agree with that policy or not, I mean without getting into the morality issue about polluting the planet, car companies won't spend the extra money unless they're forced to. Another great example of this is airbags. Of course, up in the first world, United States and Europe, airbags have been legislated for many years. But down here in Latin America, in the third world, there are no laws saying that cars have to be sold with airbags. The fact is, you can go into any new car dealership and buy a brand new car off the floor with no airbags at all, if you so choose. Down here, stripped-down versions of basic cars often don't have any airbags at all or just a driver's side airbag. And another thing, after a car has been in an accident and the airbags have blown, if it has them, almost no one ever gets them reinstalled. They're just too damn expensive, like $1,000 a piece. And I've found out that even if you do have car insurance and it covers your accident, there's absolutely no guarantee when you get that car back from the shop that a new airbag has actually been installed, or if it has, that it even works. Because, you know, down here in Latin America, they don't have consumer product safety commissions. In other words, no one's minding the store, so it's always a case of buyer beware. And while I'm on the subject of cars, I just got some information from one of the biggest car insurers in Latin America. And these are compiled statistics of car thefts that I'm sure are going to interest you. Let's talk about brands first. The number one brand stolen is Toyota. Number two, Mazda. Number three, Mitsubishi. Number four, Nissan. Number five, Honda. Now that in itself is very informative. What does that tell us? All of those brands are Japanese brands, not Korean, not U.S., not European. Obviously, thieves prefer their cars made in Japan. So let that be a lesson to you when you buy one down here. Buy anything but Japanese and you're automatically beating the odds. And here's some more interesting car robbery stats. Thieves down here prefer to steal cars of a certain color, too. And white is the color most stolen. Second, gray. Third, blue. Fourth, red. So if you pick boring beige or vomit yellow or even puke green, that's another way to beat the odds. And they've even got it broken down to the time of day when cars are most stolen. Down here in Latin America, the vast majority of cars are stolen between 11 o'clock and 1 in the afternoon. That's lunchtime. And most are stolen from fast food parking lots like McDonald's, Wendy's, Kentucky Fried, and Burger King. So what's that tell us? Well, at lunchtime, you beat the odds by going home, bringing a sack lunch, or going to a restaurant that serves real food. And here's a quick update. Find me and Robert Culpepper, the Expat Wisdom guys, at expatwisdom.com, of course, and on Twitter. The Twitter handle is @expatwisdom.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, coming to you each week from somewhere south of the border. And don't forget, you can email me on anything at all about Latin America, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. See you next time. Nos vemos.
She was a picture.